Senate Judiciary Committee, Wednesday, June 26, 1991.
Destruction was appropriate in this case. If a case was alive, criminal case was still pending, and likely the conviction or possible the conviction would be obtained, then the destruction order could be denied by the trial court. And that would also preserve the state police's interest, because if in fact the sample were destroyed under court order and conviction subsequently obtained, then the police would be able to get the sample after that.
Thank you.
Yes, any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yes, Dave Fedanke. Sure.
Good afternoon. I'm Russ Shepherd. I represent the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. The areas of this bill that I wish to address are sections 12 and 13 dealing with the automatic admissibility of the DNA test. As you've heard, this bill would modify Chapter 136 to say that the analysis of DNA is admissible without question. It would effectively eliminate all pretrial litigation, and I suggest to you that in this type of case, pretrial litigation is absolutely crucial to the fair use of DNA. I'm not today objecting to the technology itself, but I think what I need to stress to you is that we need an analysis by a judge before a jury is impaneled over how the test was done in that specific case, for a judge to make a ruling of whether that testing is in fact relevant as a matter of law and can be presented to the jury. And if you were to adopt this bill as it presently stands, we'd be doing away with that process. I can envisage a situation where the state's analyst would even acknowledge that the test was done improperly, but that person would still be allowed to testify to the jury that, notwithstanding the problems we had with the testing, there is a 40 million to 1 chance that somebody other than the defendant committed this crime. And in this DNA arena, we will be dealing with numbers like that. The defense could then put on experts saying, yes, there were problems with the testing, but we'll know which evidence is going to stick in the jury's mind, and that's the 40 million to 1. This person's going to be found guilty even if there were severe difficulties with the testing. So we need a fine-tooth comb in this DNA area, and all we're asking you to do is to leave the law as it presently stands and where it should stand, and that would be by deleting the last two sections of the bill. You have an amendment which does that. I don't know how it's denominated, but I'd ask you to look favorably upon that.
He's referring to the B-5.
B-5.
So, any questions? Ms. Shepherd, I guess I wanted to, but as I understand, part of the procedure now is that they litigate the validity of the of DNA evidence, period.
I think that has been done in some cases, but Senator, I think that's, it may be part, in the technology itself may be part and parcel of the discussion of the testing that was done in the individual case. So I think that that's necessarily going to have to be explained to the judge and to the jury.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you very
thank
much,
you.
Ross.
Mr. Chair, may I
yes.
Comment? Senator Cohen asked me to make the committee aware of the case of State versus Brown, which is an Oregon Supreme Court case. It appears at 297 Oregon 404. It's a 1984 case. And that case dealt with polygraph evidence, but basically it was in that case that the court set forth and developed the criteria by which scientific evidence in a general sense would be considered by the court. And the court pointed out in that decision, and I'm looking at page 408, that the legislature in the commentary to the Oregon Evidence Code had basically indicated that the Legislative Assembly leaves for judicial decision the standard to be used in determining the admissibility of novel scientific evidence. She asked me to make you aware of that only so that if the committee decided that it would pass the bill as is, it would be aware that it was changing this delegation of this not really a delegation, but a recognition that the court may be an appropriate body to make a determination on admissibility.
Thank you.
Yes, Dave Fedanke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, David Fedanke, ACLU of Oregon. Wanted to raise a couple of additional issues beyond those that have already been brought to your attention. The ACLU does support the Dash B5 amendment. I am certainly not an expert in this test. I have spoken with Professor Aaron Novick at the University of Oregon regarding the test, who is the former head of the Institute for Molecular Biology, has done a significant amount of research in the area of DNA over the years. The understanding that I have is that this technology is very sophisticated and must be done. These tests must be done very, very carefully in order for the results to be reliable. Professor Novick is not an expert on the literature regarding the accuracy of these tests for criminal law purposes, but he is an expert on DNA, and I think that the major point he tried to get across to me in our telephone conversation was that DNA is very complex. I mean, that is what potentially makes this test useful in the criminal justice field. But it has to be done properly under very carefully controlled circumstances. And those issues, the ACLU believes, are issues that should be taken up in the context of individual cases rather than having an ad hoc decision being made by this legislative body as to whether or not the evidence is shall be admissible. And we therefore support deleting sections 12 and 13 of the bill. Two other issues I'd like to raise with you. One is the issue as to whether or not this provision will violate the warrant requirement of the Oregon Bill of Rights. We're clearly talking about a seizure here of a person's blood. Under current practice, we take fingerprints of people arrested for crimes. Blood tests are more intrusive than fingerprints. Here, we are taking the sample at a time when the person has already been convicted in order to set it aside for use at a possible future date in a future criminal prosecution. At the time the sample is being taken and the analysis is being done, there is, of course, no future offense. And I don't know what the answer to this question is, but I wanted to bring it to the committee's attention. It may be that it is not constitutionally permissible to take this evidence at this time. And let's try and step back away from this. And I understand this is not an argument that is one that, you know, we're going to feel good about in this context. I mean, we're talking about people who have committed heinous crimes for the most part. And we want to do what we can to prevent these people from committing future crimes. And I don't mean to take anything away from the laudable goal of this legislation. But I think we need to step back away from it and think about, are we doing something here other than creating a mechanism that essentially is going to allow the police at a future date to canvass the usual suspects and attach criminal culpability to someone on the basis of technology that we hope is highly reliable, that this body is being asked to make a judgment as to whether or not it is highly reliable. And that is disturbing, I think. And again, I'd be much more comfortable leaving this in the context of individual courts to determine in terms of the admissibility in a future case. And rather than just making an ad hoc decision here that it's going to be admissible. The final point I wanted to raise is Section 5 of the bill, which applies the provisions to everyone who is currently incarcerated.
Excuse me, Senator Shoemaker.
I lost the thread there, Dave. You said you were concerned that this was a warrantless search.
Right.
Gather evidence to be used
in a future
time at hand, but the future, and there is no reasonable, no practical.
No individualized suspicion,
right,
because there's no crime yet.
That was, I was tracking along with that. Then you talked about, thus, the admissibility.
Well, I
should perhaps, we should adopt the B-5 amendments, or A-5 amendments.
Well, I think it's another reason to adopt the B-5 amendments.
They're two different threads.
They are. There. Yes, they are. Yes. I think
regardless
of there's one question.
If it's a warrantless search,
it would be prohibited.
Then you just have to say no to the whole bill.
It would be prohibited until a later date when there was some individualized suspicion and probable cause of a new offense. I mean, I think there may be something of a catch-22 here in that the state may be able to get a search warrant to do the DNA analysis prior to a person's conviction based on probable cause, or they may be able to do it at a later time when they have probable cause that the individual has committed a new offense. I think what may cause the constitutional problem here is that there is currently no offense for which the search.
Nor probable cause to believe that there will be.
Exactly. But it is exacerbated, I think, by the last two sections of the bill. Section 5 of the bill provides that everyone who is currently incarcerated must submit to the drawing of a blood sample. And we believe that that provision may violate the ex post facto provision of the Oregon Bill of Rights, possibly the Federal Bill of Rights, although not as likely there. And I believe the key issue would be whether or not this is an additional condition of the sentence, if you will. The rest of the bill, in terms of people who are convicted following the effective date of this act, makes it a condition of the sentencing order that the defendant submit to the blood test. Here we have the same condition being imposed on people who have already been sentenced, and I think that may cause ex post facto problems. We would urge you to delete Section 5 of the bill if you're going to move forward with it and only apply it to people who are convicted after the effective date of the act. That's all I have. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Among the documents that you were provided is a copy of an opinion in a Western District of Virginia Federal District Court case. It's called Lawrence Jones versus Edward Murray. And for what it's worth, it appears to be the only written opinion dealing with some of the constitutional issues.
Search issue.
Yes. And of course, it has nothing to do with Oregon law, but in terms of the federal analysis, it does talk about the warrant issue, and basically the rationale of the decision is that this is not an unreasonable search or seizure, and consequently is not subject to the warrant provision. And they recognize as well that a warrant procedure would be utterly unworkable with respect to detecting future crimes in the first place. But the decision basically is that you balance interests, and when you do that in this instance, the danger of recidivism is great enough that the state is warranted in a reasonable, what they conclude to be under these circumstances, a reasonable seizure. We also deal with the ex post facto issue and determine, at least for purposes of this case, that it is not a penalty. And consequently, you are not increasing punishment, and therefore you can extract blood from prisoners who were sentenced prior to the effective date of the act. And in terms of what Oregon law would be, it's of course, difficult to conjecture. But in the Milligan case, which appears at 304 Oregon, 659, it's a 1988 case, they're talking about blood seized in connection with motor vehicle violation, but basically recognize that obviously the taking of blood is a search and a seizure. I think it's quite different from this analysis, so probably not here.
Okay, are there yeah. questions of Ingrid with respect to this bill? I guess Carrie's here. You want to come on up? Catherine actually had signed up, so I don't know whether you want to make any comments right now.
Carrie Barnett, Governor's staff, I just wanted to throw in a quick two cents that we're very supportive of the bill. We think you know that. Be pleased to answer any questions we can, although in most cases I think we would defer to the Attorney General's office, the experts on the bill.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator.
Could you just clarify the amendments for the Governor's office one more time?
I would be happy to run through those if that would be helpful. I think it's probably not something that Mr. Barnett is.
Do you have a copy of them with you?
Sure.
The dashboard.
Yeah. I guess.
Maybe right.
We need to ask you if you have a position on, is it Section 5, the admissibility question?
Section 13.
Section 13. And 5, I guess.
The
ex post facto.
Is that the admissibility
section? Yes, I'm asking. Yes. Go ahead, Carrie, if you'd like to.
Madam Chair, we are supportive of the bill with or without the admissibility section in it. It's, as you know, it's a fairly complicated matter, which, to be honest, we have not done a lot of detailed research on. We would, again, tend to defer to the Attorney General's office, which has done quite a bit of research on the matter. The governor is supportive of the bill with or without that section in it.
Thank you. That's important for us. Any other questions?
I just want to make sure, how much does this narrow the application list down, the A4 amendments?
We haven't been through a description, and would that be helpful?
Oh, please, yes. I think it's time to.
And again, although they're designated A4, they work with the B engrossed version of the bill. In terms of the offenses which are covered by the measure, the amendments would delete contributing to the sexual delinquency of a minor, would delete sexual misconduct, and would delete two of the categories of public indecency, leaving only the subcategory of that offense, which includes exposure with a sexual purpose. Otherwise, the offenses would remain the same. Then the next amendment, on page 2 of the bill, line 16, clarifies that although no test results or opinion based on a test result should be rendered inadmissible solely because of deviations from procedures adopted by the state police, it adds the provision, so long as those deviations do not affect the reliability of the opinion or test result. Then on page 3 of the bill, on line 4, the amendments would delete or paternity proceedings so that these provisions would relate only to criminal prosecutions and juvenile proceedings. In line 16 on page 3, the word inspect or would be deleted.
May I go back to the original, the paternity proceeding? Did I hear testimony incorrectly that we currently use it?
Madam Chair, Senator Hamby, yes, by statute.
By statute.
Evidence of DNA analysis is currently admissible and is routinely used in paternity proceedings. This, frankly, this short phrase that is being deleted here was left in the bill as an artifact from a previous draft and related only to disclosure of information from the database in paternity proceedings, and we excluded paternity proceedings from access to this criminal history or criminal database.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Go ahead.
The next amendment is again on page 3, and this is at lines 16 and 17. And at this point, the bill says, in any case, the department, meaning the state police, is not required to allow the person, being the person whose sample we're talking about, or anyone acting on the person's behalf, to inspect or test any blood sample, audio, radiograph, or other physical evidence. This would delete the word inspect and add to that, the department shall adopt procedures governing the inspection of records, samples, and autoradiographs and challenges to the accuracy of records. Such procedures shall accommodate the need to preserve these materials from contamination and destruction so as to eliminate the absolute bar to inspection of those, but adopt rules that would govern the inspection and challenging of the procedures used. And that's the extent of the A4 amendments.
Okay, do we have any other questions of the people in front of us here for now? Senator Shoemaker or anyone
else? No more.
Okay. We're short of a quorum. We'll see where we are with this. So we have to, we can take some.
Be back. Senator Hill.
Mm-hmm. Well, he'll be back in 5 minutes probably. We had to go make a vote in trade committee or some.
Oh, yes, a quorum, I'm afraid.
How are they doing in trade?
PR effort for force products.
And
the last bill.
Congress Committee on 3495 is scheduled to begin at 3. I've asked Dick to come down and let us know when the House people are there and
right.
We can decide whether to
right.
Go or
I think that's fair.
Reschedule or whatever.
Yeah.
You need to
know
that's coming up and I want.
Do we know where Brockman or Bunner?
No, I don't know. Let's, do we want to go ahead and then have, do, huh? Do you want to do 2944? Okay, let's see where you are. Bill, let's take up 2944.
Okay, Madam Chair.
Briefly,
I would like to pass out some amendments to the bill and the engrossed version from the last two pages of the bill.
So we have B5 plus deletion. That's it.
Let me give you your five factors.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, if I could, the amendments that I just passed out with the engrossed version of the combined efforts of Senator Shoemaker, Mr. Toeffler, Mr. Junda, and Bob Asmus, and a little bit of myself here. And what the amendments do is delete the whole bill up until page 11. The first part of the bill relates to mental health services or mental health commitment for people who are drug dependent or alcohol dependent. The remainder of the bill relates to holes for in transportation for a person who's suffering from mental health illnesses and is in need of emergency assistance. I believe that Mr. Toeffler, Mr. Junder, and Mr. Asmus would like to address the committee on the need for the changes and also for the need for what is now Section 22 of the bill.
Thank you. Yes, well, we might as well get all three of you up here who have signed up. See if we can dispose of this. Session at what time today?
4:30.
4:30? Okay. Thank you. Why don't you go ahead?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Steve Toeffler. I represent Legacy Health System. With me is Bob Jundeff, who's with the Oregon Psychiatric Association, or Mental Health Association, I guess the accurate terminology. What I'm attempting to accomplish here is a legal authority to transport somebody who is in need of emergency mental health services because they're dangerous to self or others from one hospital to another. This authority doesn't exist. We developed with a group of folks involved back in April a concept to do this. We're unable to find a vehicle in the Senate, over to the House, put it in 2944, and as you're aware, the House has adopted that bill, but it includes some controversial issues that are probably a little difficult to deal.
Why do you need the part that's remaining?
Simply to allow transport from one hospital to another. Right now, without it, there is liability. If there was an automobile accident, for example, between the two hospitals, who knows what kind of liability the physicians that authorized the transport or, for that matter, the police agency have without this authority. So in the last 20 minutes, working with counsel and with Mr. Jundeff and with the assistance of Brett Asman of the Mental Health Division, we've crafted this set of amendments, which I think will solve the problem, give us the authority, and would it impair the rights of the individuals. My intent here is to have the record very clear that we don't want to change the two-physician hold, the current law. We simply are looking for authority to be able to move somebody from Good Sam, let's say, or Emmanuel to Holiday Park or to the Oregon Health Sciences University where they have certified mental health facilities.
Thank you. Bob.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Bob Junda.
I see that you originally signed up against the original bill here, or maybe you're still against what Section 22.
Given the changes, Madam Chair, we have no opposition to the bill. The only point two points of clarification, one being that this would address the situation where a person was in one health care facility who needed psychiatric treatment on a hold and needed to be brought to another. And right now, it's very cumbersome to make that happen. Our only concern would be that in earlier part of the section, which says that in no case shall a person be held in a hospital for longer than 5 judicial days without a hearing, it would be that would be understood to cover both hold situations, both the two-physician hold situation and the additional time covered by the transport hold. With that understanding, I think that this version will work quite well.
Okay, thank you. Other questions?
A couple of questions of Steve. Proposed amendments reduce from 24 hours to 12 hours the the time after the examination that may elapse before the statement is made, and also limits to 12 hours the amount of time that this person can be held before transported, being transported. I guess I have two questions. One, is that workable? And secondly, do you need as long as 12 hours?
Madam Chair, Senator, the practical standpoint, at least within the problems I'm aware of within our system, is that 12 hours is certainly ample time. I think we're trying to write this in a way that will also reflect circumstances elsewhere in the state other than just the Portland metropolitan area, and I think we've all agreed that 12 hours isn't an appropriate time. Okay. And will work. And the purpose of having it in both sections is to make sure it's consistent, so we don't say 6 in one and 12 in another.
Just for my own, just to be sure I understand, we now would refer to that you can hold this person in a healthcare facility licensed under ORS 431, Chapter 431. What is that?
Purpose, Madam Chair, Senator Shoemaker, the purpose of that is to confine this hold to a licensed hospital, which is the reference here, rather than a physician's office or jail or some other place. We want to confine this really just to hospitals so that we're solving the hospital-to-hospital transport problem.
Okay. These are...